My oldest brother, who lives in Greenwood now, first started going to the NAACP meetings that they were having in Greenwood on Avenue I. He became chum friendly with Sam Block and Willie Peacock. And they would have these little private meetings, and we heard the whispering going on in town, but it didn't, you know, really excite us at that point, you know, because it was just a whisper. But
what was your brother's name?
Theodore.
Theodore.
Theodore. And he and my grandmother, he's my grandmother's pa, he and my grandmother would lie in the room and talk. You know, he would be telling about what's going on. Because she literally, once she found out what was going on, she would send him down there. And he would come back and tell her what was happening. So it became publicly known that the NAACP was coming to, you know, openly invite the community out to, you know, membership drives, you know, active campaign of getting people involved, more involved in the NAACP. And this particular day, we happened to be coming from school, my sister and I. This is in the latter part of 62. My sister and I and about three other girls was walking from school. And we saw these men out passing out leaflets, you know, stopping us at the high school, you know, from Broad Street to where we lived on Noel Street. They was all down on most of the corners, you know, passing out leaflets, you know, telling us, you know, to come out to mass meetings and why they were in town and what they intended to do and what have you. So we was little silly, you know, girls growing up in the community. We giggled, you know, and what have you, and really never gave it any serious thought until it became more openly talked about. And then some of the local people began to get involved, like Freddie Green's father, Mr. Dewey Green. Mm-hmm. I think, if I'm not mistaken, he at that time was the president of the NAACP, but he was friending it. His name is Mr. Dewey Green. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you talked with the Green family while you were there.
I haven't, but I know the name.
Now, one of his daughters lives here in Washington. I'll give you her phone number while you're here. And Sam Block and Willie Peacock was more vulnerable in the community than anybody. So people began to take up a friendly friendship with them because, you know, George Green and his sister Freddie was in high school, and they, you know, started getting involved. And they were somewhat like the organizer for the school system. You know, they were on a high school level. And a young lady by the name of Patricia Mixon. I don't know what happened to Pat. So our way of coming home was from Newell Street to McLaurin's, from McLaurin's to Avenue H, which we passed by David Jordan's home, to Broad Street. That was our route to go to school. And we made it a habit of keeping that same route because that would give us the opportunity of going by the Freedom Office, and we would get a chance to see, you know, the men there, you know, Sam Block, Willie Peacock, Hollis Watkin, and you had a guy by the name of Brown.
Malone Brown.
Mm-hmm. And then you had, later on, other people started coming, like Charles McLaurin's, Jesse Harris, Jimmy Travis, and people start in and out, gee out, and what have you. So, this particular day, I ran into Bob Moses, who was standing at the corner of Avenue H and Broad Street. And it looked like it was a coincidence around that particular time in the morning, because I had to be to school by 8 o'clock. I would run into him, and he would chat with me, and I was very inquisitive. I'm a very talkative person. I like people. By nature, I like people. That time I get frustrated with.
Mm-hmm.
So I would be asking Bob all these questions, and he would carry my books, and he'd walk me to school. And my interest had basically somewhat drifted away from school because I was so curious about what this man was saying to me and what was going on. I was always being pulled on the carpet by, you know, the teachers, and they were saying, always saying derogatory things about the people, you know, what was going on. But the attitude at that time was very segregationist. teachers couldn't even talk about being first-class citizens. They could not literally go to the mass meetings. And they would call us in and ask us, you know, what's going on and what have you. And we became very frustrated about that. And it would became a situation where we were defending the freedom people as opposed to the respect of their being the person that was in authority, because what they was trying to do, they was trying to suppress our minds in terms of how we thought about what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
All kinds of rumors, you know, to discredit, you know, what the overtone was about. They did that. You know, they said they heard of young women going down there sleeping with the people in SNCC. They heard of people, babies, young women getting pregnant, and most of us stopped. Getting our hair done, we start wearing the afro. Frank Smith's wife, when she came to Greenwood, Frank Smith and Martha Prescott, Jean Wheeler was her name at that time, and Martha Prescott, I think, were the two people that exposed me or some of us to the natural.
Mm-hmm.
So we start wearing our hair natural. And my particular teacher stated to me that she would actually pay for me to get my hair done. And I told her, you know, I liked it the way it was. So Mr. Threadgear was, he was a Tom from his heart. Whatever the system said, he did it. And so this particular evening, my sister, myself, a girl named Willoughby Thomas, and Aaron's Brook, we stopped by the office on McLaurin Street. And Bob was in there. We was, you know, we was curious and what have you. And he's such a mild-mannered person. He asked us to come and sit. Did we want to look around and what have you? So my sister would always push me up, you know, to do things. She said, June, you asked the question, you know.
She's younger or older than you?
She's a year older than I am. Mm-hmm. She's in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And what's her name?
Dorothy.
Mm-hmm.
Dorothy Weddington. So I asked Bob, you know, what was they there for and why did they come there and did they think that it was safe for them to come to Greenwood and what is it that they wanted us to do and what have you. So he was telling us about what he wanted. They were there to make sure that blacks become first-class citizens. And they wanted us to get involved, to help canvass the community, pass out leaflets, and blah, blah, blah. So Bob had these canvas notebooks prepared. So we had agreed that we would come back. He asked us if we could ask our parent to come to a meeting around 7 o'clock. He was going to teach us how you do voter registration, campaigning, and what have you. So what happened was that my sister agrees, oh, June, yeah, go on, take the notebook, you know. So I said, okay. So we took the notebook, and we all was on our way home, and we was trying to figure up some kind of lie. How was we going to get out of this, and whether or not we was going to come back, and what we had to do, and how we was going to get our lesson done, and what we were going to say in terms of coming back, you know, for 7 o'clock. Well, I think Bob somewhat knew that we were lying, that we wouldn't be back. I think he somewhat knew that. But I had all the intentions of coming back, because I was just going to tell the truth, you know, and come back. So when we got near home, Aaron's kept making a little statement about her mother was going to get her, and Willoughby kept talking about her mother would get her. So my sister said, well, June, you take the notebook. I said, well, you go through the front door, and I'll go through the back. So I took the notebook, and I went in the back door, and my second oldest sister saw me come in the house with the book. And she said, we called our mother by her name. Her name was Lulabelle, and we called Bea. She said, I'm going to tell Bea you all been down to that old freedom office again. So sure enough, Bea, Lula went and told her. And she called us out on the front porch, and she told us to go in the house and put the book down, do our chores, and do our homework. And said, I want you all to take those books back down there. And I mean, don't go back to that place anymore. So Willoughby called, Aaron called, and my sister and I, we said, well, we're going to have to go. So we went back that night to take the books, and Bob was there. So we had some little fictitious story to tell. And eventually, we just had to tell the truth about parents who were going to bring back, because he knew that. But he didn't take it. Either way, it didn't bother him. It didn't bother him because I guess he knew it was a process of adjustment. You know, getting used to the rejection, getting used to people being reluctant to actually get involved, getting used to the trust, you know, getting used to the reactionary position or attitude that our parent would take towards some strangers that had come to a town that we didn't know anything about, and they said they had an agenda, you know, mm-hmm. and what have you. So we took the books and we sat around and we talked and went on. And I started going back to school, and I would really meet him just about every morning on this corner, because I think the problem was, it wasn't a problem, the fact that he lived near the Freedom House or lived in that vicinity. I was going to school and he was coming that way. He would always, you know, walk me to school or walk me halfway to school. So my mother worked from 5 to 3 in the morning. She would go to work at like 5 o'clock. And she would get off like at 3. She was cooking at a restaurant, a nightclub, called Club, I think it was called the Paradise Inn. I think that was the name of the Paradise Inn. So that meant she was gone. My daddy worked at the Compress, and he normally got off of work between 6 and 7 o'clock. And in the fall, he would be late because of the fact that was the cotton picking season. Cotton was being harvested at that particular time. Normally, we would go to the field around September and October to pick cotton. My mother worked in the nightclub. My father worked. My grandmother would go as a migrant farm worker down to Florida or to North Carolina. She would go to Florida to pick oranges, North Carolina to do tobacco and stuff like that. So my grandmother would be away. My mother was going to work at 5, and my father would already be at work or would have to work along a shift at night. Mm-hmm. And that left us at home by ourselves. So what happened, my sisters were left, you know, the older one was left in responsible for us. So I guess I was the headache. I would always slip away and go down there to see what was going on. So when I got home, when my mother got home at night, I would really get punished. I knew I was going to be punished, but it was a curiosity. It was a situation that I wanted to know what was happening and, you know, what was these people doing here. And to be honest with you, I really never had an interest. I really thought that I was going to end up in an orphanage home, you know, because I heard that so much from this teacher. I heard it from the community. We didn't have anything to be into. We really, really didn't, you know. Picking cotton and chopping cotton was a way of life. That was what it was. You know, because I was like 13, turning 14 years of age. I wasn't dating. I could only go to the playground or go to my daddy's grandmother's house or go and visit some of my relatives. But I'm talking about in terms of girls' club or boys' club or going off to summer camp. You never heard of it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't hear of it. Mm-hmm. So my real exposure came in 1963 when Bobman went to their first, went to one of their spring conferences in Atlanta at Gamblin Seminary. And I had never been out of Mississippi in my life. That was mm-hmm. in 1963. Mm-hmm. And I begged, I cried, I thought about running off, I did everything because I wanted to go. So I put Bob up to go and ask my mother, and he went. He and Anel Ponder agreed that they would be responsible for me. So there you had myself, Freddie Green, Charlie May King, I think there was several other people from Greenwood that went to this conference. And we didn't know a lot of the stuff that was going on, you know, the dialogue, and we sit and listen at people talking, what have you. So we came back home, and we had to get before, in one of the mass meetings, we had to get up and talk about our experience. And Lawrence Yeard kind of pushed us on up front, you know, to talk about what we had experienced and what we saw and what we heard and how did we feel about that. That was our first public, other than saying the Easter speech. That was our first public appearance of getting up trying to talk.
Easter, all the kids had to talk in church on Easter?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Basically, you know, most parents are, it was mandatory that most kids get an Easter speech Sunday for Easter. So we did that.
Where did y'all go to church?
I went to Strangers Home Missionary Baptist Church. That's where my family, remember, That church never opened their doors to civil rights. Never. Mm-hmm. Not even to this day.
Is that, was it in Greenwood or?
It's still in Greenwood, mm-hmm. 2 blocks from where my family live mm-hmm. now. And they're still, you know, still members of that particular church. And school was out. So there was a workshop coming up in Charleston, South Carolina. It was a nonviolent workshop, you know, talking about techniques in terms of how you protect yourself and defend yourself from any physical damage or harm. So I wanted to go to that, and I went to that, and I went with a different grouping. You know, I went with Fannie Lou Hamer, Uvesta Simpson, Rosemary Freeman, a young man named Brown, and several other people I can't recall right now. We went, we stayed there, and on our way back, we stopped in Columbus, Mississippi. We was riding Trailway Bus Station, and we had a layover Trailway bus. We had a layover there in the Trailway Bus Terminal. And we had tried to sit at the lunch counter, and there was some confusion, but it was not a major confusion because we were there for a long time, and we were discussing, you know, how we were going to deal with the situation. And their partner was with us also. So it was about time for the bus to come, and we all decided that we would sit in the front of the bus as opposed to sitting in the back, you know, and to see what the reaction was. We also discussed if one was in trouble, we all were in trouble. It was about the collective effort of sticking together and for safety purposes. And Mrs. Hamer was somewhat drafted or chosen as the leader or the spokesperson, you know, for each of us, and we respected that. And she and I had gotten in front of the line to get on the bus, but the white bus driver came and took a little white girl from the back of that line and pulled her in front of us, literally pushed us to the ground and told us niggas to get back, and took this little white girl and put her on the bus, and then took all the people around us, you know, and made sure they got on the bus. So it was a coincidence that we still was able to get on the bus, and we got halfway the front. And we told the bus driver that he was violating our civil rights and our constitutional right, and we were going to file a complaint with the Trailway Bus Company about how we had been treated, and we wanted his name and his badge and blah, blah, blah. En route to Winona, which was our next stop.
So you were sitting in the middle of the bus at this point?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Millways the bus.
And did he object to that?
He had some objection, but, you know, we had taken an attitude, you know, we wasn't going to get up. We just stayed there. We mm-hmm. sang and we talked and, you know, what have you. En route to Winona, in every little stop between Columbus, Mississippi and to Winona, this man stopped and made a telephone call. And we had basically concluded that we were going to run into some problems once we got to Winona, because Mrs. Hamer was up from around Kilmichael, Mississippi. And when we got to the bus tournament there in Winona, we knew we had been set up because there were highway patrol and police officers and white folks standing around. So we went into the lunch counter. We asked to be served. The white woman was rude and nasty, and she told they didn't serve niggas. We had to get up and leave and go on the other side. And we sat there, and the next thing we knew, there were police officers and highway patrolmen around us just snatching us, throwing us out, and telling us not to come back in. And this is a phase of this story I tell all the time that I never forgot. I have never forgotten. There was a big, fat, white guy that was standing with a pair of dungarees on and a white t-shirt. When we all were thrown out of the bus, I mean, we stood out and we talked about what was our next, you know, move. What would we do? Do we walk away? Do we go back? Or do we go to jail? This, we walked over, myself and Uvesta, most of us just walked over and took down the highway patrol tag number. This white guy went back inside and said something. I don't know what he said, but whatever he said triggered all of those law enforcers off, and they came out immediately and attacked us and arrested us and, you know, took us off jail. Miss Hamer had gone to sit because she was having problems with her leg. And when she saw us being arrested, we started, you know, calling her. And there was another girl left on the bus and a friend of ours that I grew up with, Bernard. I can't think of his name. But he and Laverne were still on the bus. Bernard Washington was still on the bus. Mrs. Hamer got off the bus, and she said, "What do you all want me to do? Go ahead," and blah, blah, blah. And by that time, one of the police officers shouted, said, "Get that son, black son of a bitch, and place on the rest, too." We were all brought down to the jail, and when we got there, somebody apparently had busted a whiskey still, because there was a whiskey still that had been taken from the woods somewhere, shaped like an old wood stove, was sitting there. And the jail was, oh, I would say that you'd partition this part of this wall off. That was the extent of the jail, mm-hmm. you know. And we could see some of the inmates, and it was about 8 or 9 police officers. I know it was the chief, the highway patrol, and several people in plain clothes and what have you. They start interrogating us and wanting to know why had we chosen Winona, Mississippi to come and start trouble. And they had heard about them troublemakers up in Greenwood, but we had picked the wrong city to come to, you know, to try to do anything. And at that point, they had taken one of the police officers, took his the keys, which were very heavy keys to the cell, and poked James Brown in the stomach with him, and then turned around and one took his foot and hit him in his behind. Then Uvessa was a highly light-skinned, she's very light-skinned lady. She had just moved from Racine, Wisconsin, from back to Mississippi, and Uvessa is very temple, you know, she has a very high temple. And the guy walked over and pushed her and was kind of, you know, feeling on her, and she responded. And at that point, they all turned their focus on myself and their Ponda, and said that they were going to teach me about tampering with state property. That was the allegation that they made against me, that I was tampering with state property. I didn't do anything, just go there and look at the car tag, and was writing it down. So they was questioning us about who sent us there and why did we come there, and we had made a very bad mistake, and that we wish we would had never stopped in Winona. So they placed everybody in a cell except myself. And next thing I know, I was being beat, you know, by each one of the police officers. Then they placed me in jail, and they took Anaya Ponda out. They beat her because they said she was she didn't know how to say yes, sir, to a southern white man. And they put her in jail. After they beat her, they had beaten her so badly. She had fallen, and Rosemary and I was in the cell together, but they had taken a nail and put her in another cell. So we left Rosemary, myself, and then Mrs. Hamer and Vessa. Next thing we knew, they were coming to get Mrs. Hamer. And they had taken her in the lower end of the cell. We could hear her just screaming and hollering. You know, it was like you was distance miles away, and the echo of her screaming and hollering was a very, very strange kind of, you know, feeling and a kind of voice that you really didn't want to hear. And she was beaten so badly until it became very, very clear to us that we had a lot of choices to make in terms of survival in that jail, because what they tried to do, they played a lot of mind games with us. The cells were filthy, we didn't have drinking water, the toilet was filthy. The highway patrol came in and ordered me to pull my clothes off and wash them in the commode in order for me not to have evidence and blah, blah, blah. So what I did, I tore the dress in half in some kind of way to save some of it. And I had a slip on, and I had this big pocketbook, and I had stuffed this pocketbook with some of my clothes because I wanted to have some evidence, you know, when I got out. And he would come in all time of night, and we didn't have blankets or anything to sleep on. We was just there. And what happened was that he was trying to get us to become indoctrinated to the fact that we had attacked each other, you know, and that they had been very good to us and nothing had really happened to us while we were there, and that we were, you know, spatting out on the street and we was put in jail and got into a fight. And that's how they wanted us to really think. So there was a black guy that was, I guess, was doing time around the jail that would come and was a snitcher. You know, he did a lot of little things, you know, and stuff like that. And the food was so filthy, we decided not to eat it. So he would say to us that if you want to get out of here alive, if you want to, you know, do what you're supposed to do, you better do this, or blah, 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 because this is not the place to resist. So Bernard and this girl that was left on the bus got the word to Greenwood. We know they did, because that was the next stop. We could not make a phone call. We could not make any contact with nobody. I do remember the night we stayed there, that Sunday night, that Monday night, they tried us in front of a white mob. They handcuffed all of us, took us out of jail, and walked us across the city of Winona. They were in the process of building a new jail there. And we were all found guilty. I was the youngest person because I was 14 years of age, and they were getting ready to send me off to, well, you call it Oakland Training School. And but a more common term is a bad girl school, because they said that I was a juvenile and that I was in violation of some state law, you know, to be away from my parents, what have you. So that was a real question between them and the law about my age. They wanted me to say that I was 21 years of age, and I refused to say it. You know, I was not 21, and I did not say 21. And at some point, they wanted me to leave the jail that night, but I wouldn't do it because they said that they couldn't keep me there. They had no charges against me, but yet and still they did have charges against me because there was a dispute between what had happened and my being a minor while being in the jail. So my mother did come over. My mother came over. I remember Ida and my sister Dorothy and somebody else came to see us.
Did you see Giat?
We didn't see Giat until we got out the day Mega got killed. That's the only time we saw Lawrence Giat.
Mm-hmm.
And Ida came over and got very, very, you know, reckless and what have you, and they told her if she wanted, she could get some of the same thing that we had gotten, and that the best out that for no other people to come. So my mother did come, and I wouldn't go back with her. I stayed in jail. I told her I was going to stay there. That was a commitment that we had made together. I refused to leave that jail, and I stayed there until Mrs. Hamer and the other people, you know, got out of jail. But while being there, we was constantly...
What was your mother's reaction to that? I mean, did she accept it finally, or...?
Sure, she accepted it. You know, I didn't think that anything worse could have happened or would happen to me than had already happened. My eyes were closed, literally. My head was bust wide open. My face was bruised very badly. And my body had scars all over. I had been humiliated to death because they tore all of my clothes off right there in front of all these white men, you know. And so what else could happen other than me getting killed? And they did take us out of the jail one night and put a gun on each of us to say that they did not beat us. And we were so silly. I think we were so silly and so unfearful that these people would shoot us, and it was unbelievable. And that we all denied, you know, we refused to sign the statements. And that's when we heard that Lawrence Giat, finally they broke through, it's my understanding, to the to the, I think Robert Kennedy was the Attorney General at the time, found they broke through, and it was my understanding there was a lot. I did not learn this until the early part of 80, that these people had literally planned to kill us. And there were so many internal struggles going on between, you know, SNCC decision, SLC, SCLC decision, and what have you. And Giok was the one that broke loose and protested and said, if these women can go to jail for our freedom, then we can violate whatever it is we have to go up there and see about them. So at that point, we were told that Giok was missing. But we did not know he was right there in the jail, but the Klansmen had taken him in the hills of Carroll County and beat him literally near to death. Until the day that we saw him, he was just, you know, badly bruised, beat up, and what have you. And at that point, the sheriff, the police, and several other people came to our cells and opened the door and told us we could go. And we was leery about leaving. But this was in the broad of day. We was leery about leaving. And we were so fearful of it because we didn't know whether they was trying to set us up to kill us or somebody do. Because we had been told that we was going to be beat again. And what happened, somebody from John Doerr's office, the Justice Department, he said he's from the Justice Department, John Doerr's office, and the FBI came back and told us we didn't have to be afraid, that they were there to protect us and that we could leave. And when we got out, there was Bernard Lee, the Reverend Bernard Lee. Now, have you talked with Bernard Lee? He works down at the district building. Okay. Reverend Bernard Lee, who was working with SCLC at the time, Andy Young, Hollis Watkin, and my mother, if I can think of, and a couple of other cars came and got us, took us. But on our way, they told us that Mega had been killed that night, that early that morning. And he took us to the SNCC office, and when we got there, we was met with FBI's, Justice Department, TV cameras, people, community folks, and what have you. We had not had any medical treatment the whole while we was in jail. I was flown one place. I went to Connecticut, and I ended up at William Kaufman's house. Bill Kaufman, you know who I'm talking about?
The chaplain, yeah.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I stayed with him for a while, and then Marion Wright Elderman had me. She and Bob Moses had made these arrangements. I stayed at his place, and I ended up going to summer camp in New Haven, some parts of Connecticut. And I spent most of my summer there, and while being there, the FBI came up to pick me up. But I had been instructed not to leave with nobody, so that's where I spent most of my summer. I went back to Mississippi, and that's when the March on Washington came, and I just repacked my bags and got in the car with Willie Peacott, Charles McLaurin's, Hollis Walken, and we came back to Washington to the March on Washington, and we hooked up with Bob and all of them. And then when I went back home, that was my experience for that particular year. And I ended up going back to school. And in November of 63...
Let me ask you some questions. Uh-huh. What was your reaction when you went back to school from your, let's say, your classmates?
Well, those of us who were involved, you know, they would talk to me about it, but many of the people, they wasn't involved. You know, it was not a thing that I talked to everybody about. You know, those people that were like, that was actually involved, families and stuff like that. But the real reaction came when President Kennedy got killed in November, when the federal marshals came on my job, at the school, and I was in my eighth grade math teacher's class. And this was about 1:15, and I was paged over the PA system to come to the office. There you had about two federal marshals and one of the local police officers, and they were all in the office of the principal. So he said to me, he said, Johnson, coming by my last name, he said, I didn't know that we had a student in our school that was this deeply involved in that mess that's going on down there. You know, you're a disgrace to this school.
What was the principal's name?
L.H. Threadgear.
Oh, it was Threadgear. Okay.
Uh-huh. And I was being subpoenaed for court. Our trial was coming up that November up in Oxford, Mississippi.
For the Winona stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I felt bad because I couldn't defend myself. because I didn't know what the repercussion would be. And I took the subpoena and I went back to my classroom. I was nothing but a kid, mm-hmm. you know. And what I did, I went home and, you know, somebody was always coming to my house talking to me about what had happened and what have you. We went to court in November. Oxford was a very unique situation. You know, James Meredith had just gone to integrate Ole Miss, I think it was in 62. And we was slapped in the face with the real overtone of racism, the real overtone of racism from many of the students there at Ole Miss and most of the town, because the Justice Department had an office there. And we could not live in Oxford, Mississippi in a hotel. Now here's the Justice Department office. We were in federal court. And here's a group of people that have filed, the Justice Department had sued some other people who had violated our right. We could not, they served us in their office. They would literally go out and get us hot dogs and hamburgers.
Mm-hmm. Where'd y'all stay when you were up there?
We had to stay up in Holly Springs, Mississippi. But the interesting part before that was a black cafe. The only little black cafe in that town wouldn't serve us.
In Oxford?
In Oxford, Mississippi, would not serve us. And they would go and get the food or go over to the Holiday Inn and get it and bring it back. And we would have to travel over, I would say, 45 miles one way to sleep.
Up to Holly Springs?
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Up there. Now, they pretend like that was best for us, but we didn't live in a hotel. We lived in different people's homes there in Holly Springs, Mississippi. The trial was always...
This was after Kennedy had been shot?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kennedy, the day that Kennedy got shot, I was subpoenaed to court.
Oh, okay.
On that day. That was the day that we had gotten the announcement, and the marshals came out to the school and subpoenaed me to court. And a lot of rednecks, rebel flags in the courtroom, sniggling, giggling, niggas, eight attitude, you know, you hear comments and things like that. And it's my understanding, I cannot recall this, but it's my understanding that there were several blacks, but they were more Akaton blacks that were supposed to serve on that jury. And they found out the type of case it was, and we had to go before an all-white jury, and we lost the case. Nobody was ever convicted. The state of Mississippi has not ever paid us for, you know, the traumatic experience that we've had and we still live through, because Giot has health problems for him. I suffered very badly. I ended up wearing glasses. You know, if you look at my eye, it's just about closed over here.
Mm-hmm.
And the headaches and pains and the scars that I'll be carrying for the rest of our life, we never, in no form or fashion, you know, we just had our day in court. But it was, you know, they said that we attacked each other. Nothing never happened. So from that day on...
Who represented you? Was it Dorr himself?
The Justice Department, a group of attorneys that was working with him. The particular guy that I can recall was a guy named John Rosenberg,
mm-hmm.
who was with the Justice Department at that particular time. And we lost the case. Nothing ever happened. The inmates that attacked Mrs. Hamer, they came and testified. It was a very sad moment because the guy he didn't want to do it, but he had to do it, and that was his first chance of getting the opportunity to really apologize to Mrs. Hamer. It was very emotional, you know, because he told the court he did. He was an inmate there, and he was forced to do something that against his will, but it was his life as opposed to Mrs. Hamer's life. And I went back to school, and in the summertime I just kept getting involved, you know, into, you know, different activities of the movement. And I was constantly in and out of jail. Then eventually, after I got beat in jail, that's when my mother made up her mind. She said that if I could fight for her freedom, she could fight for her own. She left a public job and never went back. When she died, she was working for one of the local Head Starts program, and she became very active in SNCC.
So your mother really never did anything until after y'all did.
She never did anything. She never went to a mass meeting. She never did nothing. She became the head cook of SNCC. And that's, you know, after I had gone to jail and she saw the condition I was in, she left that job and never went back. She never went back, and it was 12 of us, and we didn't suffer for anything. My father kept his public job. He got fired off of one job, but he kept the job that he was on until he retired a few years ago.
I'm a little bit confused. Your mother was working at the restaurant,
mm-hmm.
and she quit that job.
Mm-hmm.
After you, when she got more involved in the movement.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
Yeah, she became very actively involved in SNCC, and then she ended up being cook for SNCC because the national headquarters set up there on N Street, SNCC moved in the summer of 64. And that's where most of your students became involved.
Mm-hmm.
Greenwood was the center focus or the focus point of everything. And I think Greenwood was somewhat targeted after 1955 or 54, the killing of the Emmett Till case. I think that's what, you know, really focused a lot upon, because that was a major national and international case, and he got killed in LaFleur County.
Mm-hmm.
And our town was the home of the White Citizen Council because of the agricultural makeup of the Mississippi Delta. And the city was ran by the White Citizen Council. The state was ran by the White Citizen Council. And, you know, black people were more prone to the like of a lot of things, because one experience I do recall, my second oldest sister was in the band at school, and they occasionally had fundraising activities. They would sell brooms or candy to go off on school trips. And she and a group of girls wore some short pants downtown. This is the double standard of how the system was designed. She wore shorts, she and several other girls. My poor mother had to go down and get my sister from the police department, as opposed to white girls wearing short pants there. And my brother that's in the military now in Petersburg had gone to a local grocery store right there on the corner from where my family lived. And this happened on the 4th of July before the Civil Rights Movement came to our hometown. And we don't know what happened in the store, but the white guy chased him from the store to our front gate yard and say that he asked him if that was all he wanted. And my brother said yes. And this white boy became upset because he said yes and wanted to take him away from my family and literally beat him. My grandmother went to his rescue, and we ran and got our mother. And his father came, and because the community became very concerned about what was going on, and my mother had told all of us, you all stay on the porch, and definitely told my father to stay on the porch because it was more prone for him to get hurt as opposed to my mother, because he was a black man. And he had my brother by the arm, and my brother was holding to the fence, for him not to take him away. And at that point, my grandmother got up off of the front porch with a knife in her hand, and they was going at it from one point to the other. And then we went and got our mother, and she ran out there and went and snatched my brother and pushed him and got between my brother and the white guy to figure out what was the problem. And, you know, he was talking about he didn't respect him as a white man. He said yes to him and blah, blah, blah. And they went through that whole thing. I don't know what my mother told him, but I know he left there with tears in his eyes. And his father came down. But she made sure that he understood that he was not going to beat my brother. And his father came down and made an apology based on that his son was shell-shocked as a result of the army or a horse or something had kicked him, you know. And that particular incident, and we were orientated and educated, we never set our feet back in that store anymore. That was an experience that took place there in the local community, and eventually that store went out of business. So we, you know, after that, we just couldn't go in that store. And then other things were happening in the community. There was a constant makeup, whereas the railroad divided the two communities. in some form or fashion, there were railroads that made sure you understood the black community, where the black community was, and I understood where the white community was. And we always had white men coming from the white community into the black neighborhood chasing black women.
Mm-hmm.
My uncle told me this story about how he was chased out of Mississippi because they would literally come into the black community on Fridays and Saturday night and ask black men where could they find black women. And my uncle, well, he's dead now, but he left Chicago and said that they had taken these white men and beat them very badly because they were not going to tolerate it. And when the police came looking for them, my aunt, who's dead, told us that she and several of the older women in the neighborhood slipped them on a train, and it was not one of these commercial trains, you know, like a freight train, mm-hmm. and one of the car boxes, and helped them, gave them some money, and fixed them a little apron of food, and told them don't come back within a certain time, you know, because the whites, the police and the sheriffs and things was looking for them. And it was a bad, I remember the story of two black women that was found right there from our house on the railroad track, where they had been beaten so badly by white men, you know, because these women were supposed to have been crossing.